Welcome to the Latchkey Tales, Book 1, Yuki O'Malley and the Belfair, a tale of Victorian horror, written and performed for podcast by M.J. Hahn. Chapter 12, Snakes and Ladders. Derwinter sat in his studio, finally having a quiet moment to himself after a long night's work spent rejuvenating the remaining members of the Ouroboros Society. Despite his exhaustion, he glanced at the monitors on the wall and smiled. Different viewpoints of the bathing chamber glowed on the screens. A close-up of the teepool indicated that the baby was still resting comfortably. It was tethered via a series of tubes and connected to a homemade IV drip which was keeping it sedated. A necessary procedure, since the baby had spent the previous day in an agitated state due to the lady of the house's absence. Its skin had darkened to an inky black, and it had taken to sulking uncooperatively at the bottom of its teepool. However, as soon as Yuki was returned to Coil House, the baby's mood had improved instantly, resurfacing with its skin gleaming pink and happy once again, perfect for harvesting. Now, several crisscrossed incisions marred the baby's surface, outlining deep square depressions where the skin had been carved away. Derwinter sat there, looking quite pleased with himself. Yes, even a little smug. Dare one say it? Derwinter was outright happy. The results from the new samples he'd administered had proved to be very satisfactory, to say the least. Bilsey and Carstairs had flitted off like giggly schoolgirls. Apparently, the dosage still needed a bit of adjusting. Derwinter chuckled to himself.
What difference does it really make? Can you ever be too young?
Derwinter's smile faded as if he suddenly realized that he knew the answer to that particular question. But then his eyes brightened at the sight of the row of shimmering syringes full of his new formula.
Hard to believe it finally worked. I suppose 10th time's a charm.
Even Philgrave had regained some of the impish character of his youth, which for Philgrave was really saying something. The strange side effects of Derwinter's previous efforts had diminished once the new formula had been administered. Philgrave's faintly glowing eyes and ravenous withdrawal pains had vanished. Derwinter glanced at the shrouded cylinder in the corner of the studio.
That damnable contraption. Positively ghoulish.
Indeed, something had to be done about Philgrave and the whole Lilac Acres situation. It was a time for new beginnings, and it wouldn't do to have any future endeavors attached to some sort of shady scandal. Just another item on Derwinter's to-do list. There were still endless details to work out, including getting his little gold mine ready for public consumption. Derwinter was devising a handy little watered-down version that was just refreshing enough. Too drastic of a result could raise unwanted questions.
Not to mention a bunch of immortal imbeciles running around everywhere. Ugh, heaven forbid.
A stack of mock-ups for the new product design crowded one of the large tables in the studio, including several logo ideas for something called Aqua Deluxe. There were also piles of Kogiyama Corporation contracts that Derwinter still needed Dermal and Femur to have a look at. It was all moving so fast. Derwinter gazed at the monitors again, at the baby drugged and dissected in its teepool. He wondered what Lady Iwanaga would have to say if she was still around to see all this. The very walls seemed to resonate with her disapproval.
And once the cash starts rolling in, the first order of business will be to unload this old mausoleum.
Derwinter had been trapped in this particular gilded cage for far too long. Years beyond counting spent biding his time while trying to recapture his lady's former pet. He glanced over at the row of monitors again.
Exactly how long has it been? 50-odd years since your mother went mad and banished you. My, it has been a little while, hasn't it? I can't begin to tell you how lovely it is to have you back.
While Derwinter reminisced, his mind wandered back to darker times, remembering that things hadn't always been marvelous where the baby was concerned. It had also been responsible for one of his most painful memories, the loss of his only child, his beloved Amako, the apple of his evil eye.
Oh, poor dear. She never knew what hit her.
In those heady years following the 1906 disaster, despite raised eyebrows from polite society, Derwinter and Iwanaga were inseparable, hiding in their castle high atop Knob Hill. Soon after, Amako had arrived, delivered into the lap of luxury and doted over, her every whim catered to courtesy of Milford Coyle's fortune. In 1929, while the country was on the brink of ruin, Derwinter found the idea of a Great Depression completely ludicrous and suggested that a world tour was in order. So, while the tea maker chugged away faithfully at home, the three of them traveled in style, an exotic family that turned heads everywhere they went. But the world had changed. Revisiting the European capitals for the first time since the Great War seemed to have a tremendous effect on Lady Iwanaga. She became withdrawn and sullen when she found the impression of her previous life had faded away. She had simply outlived her illustriousness. Those that might have remembered her had either disappeared or were just long dead and forgotten. Time seemed to have left her behind. It was then that Iwanaga decided that she had traveled enough. She had seen all that she wanted to. Suddenly, her fears about leaving the baby unattended for so long became urgent, and she booked passage to return to San Francisco alone. Derwinter and Amako were having too splendid a time to quit so soon. They thrived on the energy and chaos of the new Europe, and continued their tour in high style. And before you knew it, 5 years had gone by, just like that. 1935 finally saw the debauched duo return to San Francisco. Their seemingly boundless thirst for life hadn't gone without its consequences, except for Derwinter, of course. His daily dose of a single drop from his flask kept the ravages of excess away. Amako was another story. By the time she was approaching her 26th birthday, so many late nights had already begun to leave their mark. She had always eyed Derwinter's flask enviously. She asked him nearly every day if he would let her try just a sip, but he always answered the same.
Not yet, my dear. You're perfect just the way you are.
Eventually, she got her way and was allowed to begin regular doses of the sacred tea, as well as a few skin treatments to rewind her just a little. Yet the baby didn't warm up to Amako right away. It acted a little standoffish, like it did whenever Derwinter was around. Something that didn't escape Lady Iwanaga's notice. As the 30s waned, San Francisco remained their playground, father and daughter painting the town red every night, all the while Lady Iwanaga shunning the nightlife and spending her time increasingly alone. This became routine until shortly after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. 1942 bore some unfortunate circumstances for those of Japanese descent living in the States. Even Dermal and Femur couldn't keep the law at bay where Iwanaga and Amako were concerned. They did manage to freeze any claims to the Coyle fortune, as well as deflect any scrutiny away from Derwinter. The very notion that Lady Iwanaga was a spy for the Japanese Emperor was laughable, especially if you considered how many years had passed since Lady Iwanaga had visited what the authorities called her native land. As far as she was concerned, she was a native San Franciscan, certainly one of the oldest living. Of course, Lady Iwanaga wasn't able to mention any of this, since she didn't look a day over 25. Both of Derwinter's ladies were shipped away to the Central Valley of California to what were known as exclusion areas. There, the majority of the possessions they had brought along were confiscated. This included such concealable objects as silver flasks. Marooned in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by barbed wire fences and guarded from gun towers, Iwanaga and Amako ended up in a shanty town full of dusty wooden shacks, certainly a far cry from their castle on the top of Knob Hill. In the lady's absence, Derwinter was left to his own devices, and very soon the cash had begun to dwindle. Luckily, Dermal and Femur's services had indeed proved to be miraculous. They had arranged for Derwinter to remain as custodian of Coyle House. This basically meant that he was free to do whatever he dared to think he could get away with. And so Derwinter began to improvise. Certainly, he was gifted with the survival instincts of a supreme predator. And of course, it was this inimitable savoir-faire that had attracted Lady Iwanaga to him in the first place. So, with a combination of Derwinter's irresistible charm, A city full of society matrons of a certain age, not to mention a pool full of the best beauty treatment since monkey glands, the Belfair was born. Resulting in a war spent in relative luxury for Derwinter, he managed to maintain the tea maker and the tea pool on his own, as well as successfully bottle the sacred tea, which he sold to the highest bidder. In those days, he had given up trying to close in on the baby with Iwanaga's silver knife and harvest the skin, a procedure that she had made seem so effortless. When Derwinter approached, the baby would always turn black and sink to the bottom of the tea pool, but that didn't seem to affect the quality of the tea, so he managed with what he had, and that was plenty, because even during those lean war years, his client list always seemed to be growing. Word of mouth spread like wildfire about Derwinter's miraculous tea. In a year, his following had tripled, including blue bloods from across the country and even a few starlets from Hollywood. Although they were smitten with Derwinter's funny little tea, eventually the conversation ended up in the same place. Were the rumors true? What was the mystery in the basement that could make you younger? Derwinter remained aloof on the subject, simply stating that his hands were tied until the lady of the house returned. It wasn't until the spring of 1946, nearly a year after the war officially ended, that Iwanaga and Amako were allowed to come home, a homecoming that had shocked all parties concerned.
Hello? Oh, there you are. And what is this? Sitting down on the job?
Derwinter was shaken out of his thoughts as Odula Maul sauntered into the studio, trailing a mixture of cigarette smoke and noxious gardenia.
Well, the Goldens are off on their little joyride. I hope they have a lovely time.
Derwinter looked amused. He gestured over to the table at the row of syringes.
Ready to go when you are, my dear. The large one on the end there is for you. I've packed it with a little extra kick.
Lamal's eyes flickered when she saw the shimmering formula.
It's worth mentioning that this procedure will remove, or rather reverse, all those little tinkerings of yours.
Derwinter's eyes traveled towards Lamal's forehead, to the hardware which was hiding beneath her wig.
I wouldn't worry, my dear. But this is uncharted territory where you're concerned.
Ugh, skipsy formalities.
Audra kicked off her shoes, hopped up onto one of the tables, and blew a large cloud of smoke from the corner of her mouth.
All right. What do I do? Firstly, we can get rid of this.
Derwinter tossed away Lamal's cigarette. Then his gaze fell upon her long, coppery curls.
And you can take that off as well.
Lamal appeared concerned, grasping at her tresses in a vain attempt to keep her hair fastened to her head.
Are you sure? Can't we just wait and see what happens?
Now, none of that. There's a brave girl.
Lamal curled her lip, reached up, and peeled away the wig with a distinct sound of ripping tape. Beneath a thin layer of white hair lay the halo of golden screws gleaming in the overhead light. The stretched and twisted skin looked irritated and raw. One of Lamal's head screws had come loose a bit, resulting in a sagging eyebrow that suddenly left her looking oddly schizophrenic. She smoothed back the few measly wisps of hair with obvious annoyance.
Ugh, all right, let's get this over with.
She began to push up her sleeve while Derwinter approached with the alarmingly long syringe. The opalescent compound swirled and shimmered within.
I'm afraid not. You'll have to lie back.
Lamal's mobile eyebrow quivered as she stretched out. Derwinter delicately parted the front of her gown.
It's got to be straight to the heart, my dear.
Before Audra could react, Derwinter brought the needle directly into the center of her chest. She howled in agony as he pushed the plunger in. When the syringe was empty, Derwinter pulled out the needle in a smooth arc and stood back. Lamal's head thumped back onto the table, her eyes half-lidded, her breath coming in thin rasps. A moment passed, and Derwinter checked his watch as if concerned.
Strange. The other's reaction had been instantaneous.
Of course, perhaps the others hadn't altered themselves quite as extensively as Madame Lamal. Derwinter chuckled to himself as he looked down at her. He really had no idea how old dear Audra really was. Before he had met her, she had been a virtual wasteland of every crackpot beauty treatment cold hard cash could buy. The head screws, for example. She had gotten those from a fellow named Mortmaine, who worked exclusively out of a penthouse suite on top of some cheesy casino up in Reno. Deventer shuddered at Lamal's mangled scalp.
Beastly butcher. Positively medieval.
Audra's eyelids began to flicker, and with a sudden intake of breath, her body went completely rigid, shaking with tiny tremors. She shook with several croaking bursts, then fell silent. Suddenly, there was a strange, wet grinding sound from the direction of her head. The golden screws were twisting themselves out of her skull, followed by the unnerving metallic clatter of them landing on the table. Deventer moved a little closer for a better view.
What the devil?
He had to jump out of the way from Audra's enormous chiclety dentures, which were abruptly ejected out of her mouth, uprooted by a new set of pearly whites. Lamal's face instantly softened as her features began to rearrange themselves. The evil, loose twists of skin tightened and vanished, while the raw scalp healed itself, becoming perfectly smooth. The network of blue veins disappeared, replaced with the rosy glow of fresh, young, supple skin. A youthfulness that spread clear to her fingertips, where Audra's fake purple fingernails popped off one by one as if rejected by the newly growing nails underneath. When her breathing finally became regular again, Derventer smiled. Not only was there now about an inch of baby fine golden hair sprouting from her newly perfected scalp, but beneath the pound of makeup she still had on, he could tell that his formula had done its job admirably. Eventually, Audra shuddered awake and sat bolt upright, feeling frantically at her face.
Amira, vite, vite!
Deventer was prepared and handed over a large hand mirror. She snatched it from him and closely appraised herself.
I can't tell what happened. And why do I still sound the same?
Deventer hid his amusement and merely shook his head.
Now, let's not be greedy, my dear. But as for the rest of you, why don't you get that war paint off and have a real look? Here, my dear, it's nothing but freshly scrubbed for you from now on.
Deventer handed over Audra's enormous tub of makeup remover, which he had retrieved from the ballroom. By the time she had managed to wipe her old face off, her sandy-colored hair had grown another foot and thickened, now curling gently almost to her shoulders. She looked at herself again in the hand mirror.
Desmond! Oh la la! Miraculous! Bonjour, Mademoiselle Lamolle!
Audra continued to admire herself, flipping her hair around and getting no end of joy from actually being able to get away with coquettish. Deventer tolerated this for a time, but eventually, Mamselle's continual posing in the mirror became tiresome. It was time to get down to business.
Now, I don't need to remind you how terribly important it is that you keep her occupied upstairs, yes? No sightseeing and no joyrides.
Audra sneered and fanned his words away.
Yes, yes, I know. Ugh, Desmond, why can't we just lock her away in one of the towers? So much simpler than all this tedious babysitting. Now, now, it's only for a week or so, until everything's finalized. Just don't do anything drastic. We need her undamaged, my dear.
Mademoiselle Lamolle, despite her peaches and cream complexion, didn't look happy. Deventer rolled his eyes.
Just do that thing that you do, my dear. And I don't know. You don't need to be creative. Just park her in front of the television or something. Just remember to keep at least one eye on her. And of course, I don't need to tell you. No visitors, no phone calls, and no blasted internet.
The 1972 gold Cadillac convertible, known as the Juggernaut, raced along Highway 1, heading south down the coast. The vintage radio was turned up, playing an 8-track of Morty Golden's favorite blues classics. The moonlit countryside whipped past, an endless blur temporarily illuminated by the glow of the headlights. Crowley's eyes shined with an odd luster as he stared out of the passenger side window, dazzled by the silver light of the full moon reflecting off of the ocean. He looked over thoughtfully at his dad sitting behind the wheel. It had been forever since they had gone for a long drive together. Morty Golden was having a lovely time, He had the same strange gleam in his eyes as he sat contentedly, tapping the steering wheel in time with the music. The highway had opened up to a long stretch of empty road. No signals or speed traps with the highway patrol lying in wait. He rarely had the opportunity to test the limits of the Juggernaut, his metamechanical wonder that he had been working on in his spare time for the past 20 years. The Coupe de Ville had been completely modified and fitted with its revolutionary sempiternal propulsion system, powered by something called the 7-Year Spring. The result was not quite perpetual motion, but it was pretty darn close. To put it simply, that meant that you had to only wind it up once every 7 years and it would drive forever without a drop of gasoline. Just another ingenious golden family invention.
Come on, Dad, floor it! Let's see what she's got!
Morty looked over at his son with a devilish smirk, stepped on the accelerator, and the Juggernaut shot forward. An idiotic smile spread across Crowley's face while he watched the speedometer steadily climb higher and higher. While the Goldens cheered, the car barreled through the darkness like a shot down the straightaway. Unknown to them, hidden in the distance was the curve in the road, hiding the 100-foot drop down to the jagged, rocky coastline. A hazard known locally as Devil's Slide. As the car careened dangerously towards the edge of the road, several red lights suddenly burst to life along the dashboard. The brakes engaged automatically, and the steering wheel whipped around, setting the Juggernaut into a screeching spin towards the edge of the cliff.
Whoa, Dad, look out!
Crowley was jolted out of his daze in time to see the back end of the Cadillac tip over as they began to slide backwards down the hillside towards the jagged rocks below. Yuki snapped awake to the sound of several ravens flying by her windows. Coincidentally, she had just been dreaming about Milford Coyle and his plummet off of the Widow's Walk, but that had only been part of it. The dream had shifted, and there had been someone else. A man with blonde, curly hair that had seemed very familiar. Yuki sat up, squinting in the bright late morning sunlight. She was in the living room where she had fallen asleep watching TV while waiting for Crowley to call back. Her head felt thick and heavy as she rubbed at her eyes.
Oh, REM overload.
Yuki saw her phone sitting amid the pile of her possessions, which were ruining the simplicity of the otherwise stylishly minimal coffee table. She managed to reach it while moving as little as possible. She flicked it open, then frowned.
No calls? No messages? That's weird.
She thought for sure that Crowley would have gotten in touch with her by now. It was all a little concerning. Not to mention Derventer's announcement about him being her legal guardian and all. Yuki punched a few buttons until she found the doctor's number and dialed.
Yeah, what's the deal with Derventer?
She was very curious to hear what theories the doctor might have to offer about that. Actually, the doctor had a lot of explaining to do.
And what's up with all the party pictures from 80 years ago?
While Yuki's pile of questions accumulated, she realized that the call she had made hadn't connected. There was an odd series of clicks, and then a recorded message telling her that the phone number was no longer in service.
What the?
She ended the call and dialed the number again. The same recording informed her that the doctor's number had been disconnected.
Great, now what?
And then, like magic, Yuki's phone rang. This time, her eyes lit up at the sight of the caller ID.
Crowley!
How are you? Are you okay?
Crowley seemed to stumble over his words. Yuki thought he sounded a little out of it.
Yeah, I'm fine. Are you okay?
Yeah, we're okay. My dad and I sort of had a car accident last night.
A car accident? Oh no, that's terrible. What happened?
Well, yeah, about that, it's all a little fuzzy. But it could have been a lot worse, I guess. Good thing the Juggernaut sort of has built-in safety features.
Crowley recounted as much as he could remember. He had no idea what had possessed them to try to drive off of Devil's Slide at 2 a.m. Needless to say, it had unsettled Crowley's father considerably.
Dad's sort of freaking out. His memory from yesterday is missing. The last thing he remembers was going over to the Curse Castle to snoop around, and then nothing.
And then he had Mrs. Flack arrested.
What? Mrs. Flack? That's not right.
Yeah, no kidding. He showed up at her house with the cops and said she had kidnapped me.
Kidnapped? And he was there with the cops? Uh-oh, that's not good.
Yeah, not good is putting it mildly.
Yeah, but I just meant that the last thing he needs are any more hassles at work. It could mean his badge.
Yuki tried to be sympathetic, but couldn't help feeling that the sooner Detective Golden was badgeless, the better. She decided a change of subject was in order.
So, what can we do about Tina? I looked online, but couldn't really find anything.
Yeah, no surprise there. What we need can only be found in an actual book, and an old one at that.
And do you have such a book, Mr. Golden?
Oh yeah, sure. No problemo.
Well, good then. So, when can you come over?
Her voice trailed off at the approaching sound. The distinct clacking of high heels echoed from the entry hall.
Hello? Hello? Is anybody home?
Yuki's eyes popped at the sight of Audra Lamalle entering the room.
Ah, there you are, darling. Not hiding from Mamselle, I hope.
Yuki heard Crowley buzzing in her ear.
That voice? Wait, I know that voice.
Lamalle's eyes fell on Yuki with a look of austere disapproval.
Talking on the phone when you have company. C'est très impoli. Whomever are you talking to, mon petit, when your new governess is here?
Don't mention me. Whoa, I think I just remembered something.
Yuki looked awkward and managed a quick lie.
Okay, Mr. Halliday. Well, thanks for calling.
We need to talk as soon as you can. Be careful, Yuki. And whatever you do, don't let her look you in the eye.
Yuki closed her phone, not quite sure she had heard Crowley right about that last part. She turned and looked as innocent as she could. The woman who stood in front of her looked drastically different from the virtual drag queen she had seen before. Audra wore a simple white silk dress, and her sandy blonde hair was casually brushed off of her unadorned face. Without all the makeup, she barely looked 20 years old. But her voice, her gravelly rasp, belied her lovely features.
So, mon petit, Monsieur Halliday has your number, eh?
Oh, he was just making sure that I was okay. That's all.
Lamalle's golden eyes flickered.
Ugh, well, he needn't bother. Don't worry, honey. You're safe as can be. Everybody is making sure of that.
Audra stared down at Yuki and unleashed her hardest of stares. The yellow fire in her eyes flared up and held Yuki in its grasp. As she finally realized what Crowley had meant about Lamalle's eyes, Yuki found herself enveloped in a comfy fog. Everything suddenly seemed perfectly fine. What was there to worry about? There was this nice young lady here now to take care of her. But then she heard a flicker of Crowley's voice.
Don't let her look you in the eye.
Yeah, the lady's eyes were a little strange, like a jungle cat. And why did she think everything was okay? Yuki managed to blink a few times. Audra frowned instantly and turned up the voltage of her gaze. Yuki's posture relaxed and her expression went blank again. Audra pinched her cheek and sneered.
Yes, that's a good little baboon.
Mademoiselle Lamalle sauntered into the living room and flopped down on the sofa. She flicked on the large flat-screen TV and lit a cigarette. Audra looked over at Yuki, who was still standing blankly at attention.
Mon petit, I'm so parched. What have you got to drink in this place? Oh, and while you're at it, bring Mamselle an ashtray.
And so, Chapter 12 comes to a close. I'd like to thank guest voices on this episode, Leanne Parker as Yuki. Music on the program provided by freesound.org and incomptech.com. I'd like to thank Random Coil UK for their cover of Satie's Nausea No. 1. For more info, please check out the Latchkey Tales fan page on Facebook. Please stay tuned for Chapter 13. And until then, this is MJ Han saying goodbye for now, and thanks for listening.